The next case was presented by Dr. Moll.
A 67-year-old white male, a nuclear engineer.
Wow.
And
design, that's what you get for being at Duke, huh?
Is actually designing the latest generation nuclear power plants and has a private jet to take him back and forth to Japan, because obviously the U.S. is still a little gun-shy as far as moving into the next generation of nuclear power plants. But they're apparently planning to build some of these in Japan. It's interesting. He's helped me teach the first-year medical student class. He lives in Pinehurst, North Carolina, about an hour away from our institution. And since he designs these nuclear power plants and has a jet on the runway at Pinehurst ready to zip him off to anywhere for consultations on these nuclear power plants, but really good guy, and was diagnosed with prostate cancer in April of 2005. His screening PSA was 5.5, which prompted a prostate biopsy that revealed Gleason 4 plus 4 equals 8 in the left side of the prostate, involving about 10% of the biopsy material. And the right prostate biopsy was consistent with a small focus of carcinoma with Gleason 3 plus 3 equals 6. So that was his background. Then when we saw him for the first time, his PSA was about 9 with a percent-free PSA of 12 at the time he first came to Duke for a second opinion. Because of the Gleason 8, he had an abdominal and pelvic CAT scan, which was negative for metastatic disease. And he also had a bone scan performed that was negative for metastatic disease. I don't normally do CAT scans and bone scans on low or even intermediate risk patients, but since this man had Gleason 8 disease, we did a full metastatic workup. He was counseled on the various treatment options and chose radical prostatectomy, which was performed in June of 2005, and did well from the surgery. We didn't have any surgical complications. However, his surgical pathology returned as Gleason 5 plus 3 equals 8. He had a 5 component in his primary Gleason score, so obviously we were dealing with high-grade prostate cancer. He had extracapsular extension bilaterally. 15% of his prostate gland was involved with cancer and had perineural invasion, vascular invasion present, and had lymph nodes on both the left and right side being negative for malignancy. So basically, we were dealing with a man postoperatively who had clear-cut extracapsular extension of high-risk prostate cancer, although he did have negative surgical margins.
I assume when you discussed the options with him that you talked about external beam radiation therapy with hormones.
Correct.
And how did you present that to him? Did he see a radiation oncologist, and how did that decision get made?
Generally, I would always counsel a patient with newly diagnosed prostate cancer who has high-risk features that he would have the choice of radical prostatectomy or the choice of primary external beam radiation therapy plus hormones. We also have an option where patients can come to a multidisciplinary clinic right from the get-go and see the urologist and the radiation oncologist at the same visit.
In this kind of situation, the patient turns to you and says, okay, I understand there's these two options, but what do you think's best? How do you answer and why?
Well, I'm a surgeon,
right?
And I believe that...
You got to give me a better reason than that.
Well, for this man who was in this day and age, you know, I can still consider relatively young, 67, and otherwise excellent health, still working full-time and still very valuable to society, I generally thought that radical prostatectomy was the best initial therapy, with the caveat that I counseled him right up front, that I knew he had high-risk disease, that I wasn't counseling him for surgery alone. I was counseling him for surgery as part of the first step of a multidisciplinary process. Some urologists would diss radiation, basically, oh, radical prostatectomy and, you know, radiation's no good, or maybe not to that extreme. That's clearly not the case here. I said, look, I think it's very reasonable to start with radical prostatectomy. You may very well indeed need postoperative radiation therapy in an adjuvant setting, and I'm going to have you see my radiation oncology colleague right now. Yes, he or she may talk to you about the option of just going with radiation alone. If you choose that, I'm happy. But again, my feeling would be, let's do the surgery. Let's see exactly what we were dealing with, get a sense of the tumor volume, get a sense of the grade, and then if you need post-op radiation, we'll do that. If you need post-op chemotherapy or hormones or a clinical trial, we'll do that. So again, I wasn't counseling him surgery versus radiation. I was more counseling him surgery as the first step of a multidisciplinary
right.
process.
Okay.
Now, postoperatively, we also would have had the option then to do the radiation therapy, except the dilemma we were facing is even though he had high-grade disease and even though he had extracapsular extension, his margins were negative. So it comes a little uncertain because we were theoretically had gotten rid of the primary and had negative margins, there was some uncertainty whether we would benefit with post-op radiation with negative margins. And the thinking was, since he had Gleason 5 plus 3 with negative margins, if he was going to fail, we were probably more likely to be dealing with a systemic failure as opposed to a local failure.
What was his state of mind when you discussed what had been seen pathologically?
Well, I mean, he's a very quantitative nuclear engineer.
I assume he did a bunch of research on this?
Yeah, I think he did some, although he wasn't maybe as intense as some of the patients we'll see. But nevertheless, he was an engineer. He was very intelligent and very understanding of the multidisciplinary approach needed. And he regained his continence quite quickly after the surgery. Obviously, did have erectile dysfunction. We did not attempt a nerve-sparing procedure in him. He was 67, already had erectile dysfunction, had high-risk disease features. So we did not do a nerve-sparing surgery on him. We did a wide local excision. I guess good news, bad news there. I think because of the wide local excision, that may be the reason why we got negative margins. The bad news is that we did a wide local excision and he's going to have impotence because we didn't do a nerve sparing. Anyway, when the patient came back, we offered him, since it was a CALGB 99940.
Infamous study. When exactly was this that you started talking to him about that?
We would have actually talked to him about this either late June 2005 or July of 2005.
So at that time, actually, it's interesting historically, that's when the docetaxel data was just being presented.
Right.
You know, two trials, great data, New England Journal, all this stuff. But at that exact point, and of course, that led to adjuvant trials that are ongoing now looking at docetaxel. But at that point, I think this was the only adjuvant chemo trial that was going on in the United States.
Correct.
And this is looking at mitoxantrone and prednisone.
Right, exactly. So you're absolutely right. In fact, it's interesting you bring it up. This was right in the time, you know, the two trials with docetaxel were presented.
I'm sure your oncologist was sort of looking at that thinking, you know, because now in the last couple of years now, people might look at somebody like this. I mean, I don't know whether, you know, I think people try to treat somebody like this on a study. And as I mentioned, there's a bunch of adjuvant docetaxel trials available now. But at that point, it kind of wasn't really ready to be thinking about. And this study had been going on since like 1999. They had a hard time accruing. I guess it was hormones for everybody and then randomized chemo with mitoxantrone, which is an anthracycline, which, you know, kind of like adriamycin, versus no chemo. So not an easy trial to run. You know, any trial that's chemo versus not chemo is not going to be that easy. But he was a scientist, so he was interested in it?
Yeah, he read the trial, and I was very impressed. I mean, he seemed to be willing to want to, you know, help our cause and wanted to go in the clinical trial.
Do you think that
trial
was the motivation?
I think there was some altruistic motivation.
So you see that a lot in people going on cancer trials.
Very good patient, very compliant, and easy to work with. Went on the trial and actually was randomized to the chemotherapy arm.
Interesting. How did he feel about that? A lot of people go on these trials and hope they're going to get on one arm or another. Which one did he want to get on?
He wanted to be on the chemo trial.
And there's no way he would have gotten chemo off study, I think. So that's another way people think this thing through. So he got the chemo.
He got the chemo.
Wow. So how did he do?
He actually did well. His biggest problem was not the chemotherapy. His biggest problem was hot flashes associated with the hormonal therapy. He was really bothered by hot flashes.
He was getting MAB?
He was getting MAB, and he received the six cycles of mitoxantrone and prednisone as per protocol, and that ended January 31st, 2006.
How did he do, again, in terms of quality of life, nausea, vomiting, hair loss, all that stuff?
He actually did lose his hair.
Yes, those drugs do it, for sure.
And I know more about him maybe than other patients because he's also been involved with medical student teaching. So
right.
After all this,
you've heard this story a few times.
He basically, we do a 1-2 dog and pony show with the first-year medical students trying to teach them about prostate cancer. But the big issue was his hot flashes. And initially, he was managed with clonidine, but it didn't work. And in retrospect, I'm not sure why we did that, because actually the randomized trials really don't support clonidine to prevent hot flashes. But then he went on low-dose Megace, and that actually was more effective to treat his hot flashes.
Interesting.
But interestingly, when he spoke to the medical students, he did speak about the hair loss, more matter of fact, not that he was that concerned about it. In fact, his philosophy seemed to be that since he lost his hair, it must be working. And since he wasn't having too many other side effects.
Not much GI problems, nausea, vomiting.
Not too much GI problems.
How was his activity level?
He worked.
He still worked.
Yeah.
Jetting around.
Wow. And was able to do this. And like I said, his biggest gripe has been the hot flashes. And every time I'd see him back, I kind of think that I was really going to have to coach him to be able to stick out the 2 years of hormone therapy.
And that's what that trial did call for, which is 2 years of therapy. So did he make the 2 years?
Well,
or he's just about there now?
He is just about there right now. His hormonal therapy should end in October of 2007. I saw him back just recently, and we were down to either the next to last or the last LHRH injection. And
ready to have a big party?
He's the type of guy that even though he complained about the hot flashes, I knew that he was going to stick it out. Hmm. He's just not a quitter, and I think he has a lot of pride in things. So, you know, I think, as they say, come hell or high water, he's going to get through those 2 years. And actually, he's doing better with hot flashes now.
Any other problems? How's his energy level, muscular strength, all that stuff?
Pretty good. I mean,
it's mainly hot flashes.
Mainly hot flashes is what he complained about. Now, maybe some of the other side effects he was too macho to let on to, or just basically had a philosophy on life was such that he wasn't going to complain about minor issues.
You know, it's interesting what happened historically with that trial, which was it took so long to get these patients in there for whatever reasons. Maybe there wasn't enough excitement about that form of chemotherapy or whatever, but they were getting close to finally finishing the accrual, and then they had to stop the study because they saw several cases of leukemia in the patients who got the chemo.
But that was just recently.
It was like the last, you know, the last couple months.
My understanding is at that point, they had already had over 400 patients enrolled, so they got enough.
They didn't get as many as they hoped to, but they got almost. So probably at some point, hopefully they're going to be able to say whether the chemo worked or not. But it was interesting that they stopped the study because of these three cases. And, you know, in a way, it wasn't super unpredictable. We know that anthracyclines, you know, breast cancer, everybody gets Adriamycin almost. And, you know, you see some cases of leukemia, and it's interesting in breast cancer that Adriamycin, cyclophosphamide, again, some people get taxanes too, but everybody gets that if they're going to get chemo. And now there's been a study that came out that replaced docetaxel for the Adriamycin. So it's called TC. And it looks like it's actually even more effective. But the thing is, again, even though it's rare, like 1%, less than 1%, it doesn't have that leukemia risk, and it doesn't have the risk of cardiomyopathy. So even though they're not common problems with these types of drugs, it caused this trial to close. And, you know, when you're treating in a situation when some people are cured, you don't want to have any leukemias generated.
It's interesting. You know, he brought that up when we did the thing with the medical students this spring.
Interesting. Wow.
He actually brought it up with the medical students because he said, you know, I received a letter from the National Cancer Institute telling me about this leukemia risk, and the trial was closed.
But he was already beyond that, so he
couldn't. Yeah, and he basically just shrugged his shoulders. I don't think he had a lot of regrets, but, you know, it is what it is. And basically, I think he used those terms and said, you know, these are risks. I knew that there might be risks when I signed up for this clinical trial.
I got to ask you one other thing about this case that I've always thought was kind of strange, I mean, which is that the control arm of the study was hormone therapy for 2 years, so everybody gets it. Now, if this man had said, I don't want to be in the study, or he wasn't eligible for the study, would you have given him hormone therapy?
Probably.
Or would you have waited for his PSA to come up?
I've actually treated patients both ways. I would have counseled him that the control arm of this study did have 2 years of hormonal therapy. So I would have counseled him that it would have been very reasonable off protocol to consider 2 years of hormonal therapy. And I've actually had some patients. I have another gentleman, a retired physician, very similar to this gentleman, at about the same time period in 2005, elected not to go in this trial, but elected off protocol to do the 2 years of hormone therapy like the control arm.
However, our patterns of care studies show that that is not what is normally done.
Right.
And I'm betting that many times you don't do that. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but I just think it's interesting that the control arm of this study, and then the person doesn't go on it, and they really... A lot of times people will not get, quote, what I would call adjuvant hormonal therapy, which is fine, but, you know, it's just interesting.
And by the same token, there are other patients who I've presented the exact, you know, counseled them what I think is the exact same way, and they'll come back and say, gosh, you know, I just, at this point in time, I feel well after my surgery. I don't want to take on any additional side effects associated with hormonal therapy. I think I'll wait and potentially pull the trigger on hormonal therapy if my PSA rises.
What do you think about this next generation of adjuvant trials that's out there looking at docetaxel? How do you think that's going to sit in the adjuvant setting? Because, you know, again, adjuvant's kind of different. You look, got a bunch of bone mets, you know, a very different situation than you might be cured or you might be asymptomatic for 5 or 10 years and, you know, taking chemotherapy. You know, we've seen in other tumors, breast, colon, lung, that patients want chemo, even if the benefits aren't necessarily that spectacular. You think we'll see the same thing in prostate if it turns out to work?
I'm kind of smiling because I don't know. We're just starting. It's interesting. I'll hopefully be able to answer that maybe the next time we do an interview. But we're actually just getting those trials off the ground at Duke right now.
Right.
For example, we just started a trial with Dana-Farber using docetaxel plus Avastin.
Yeah, that's a great study.
And neoadjuvantly prior to radical prostatectomy.
There's a bunch of studies.
We have one trial neoadjuvant.
Right.
And then we have a second trial in the setting of adjuvant for patients who've already been through surgery.
It's interesting if you think about it. It's great that these things are getting started. But, I mean, adjuvant chemotherapy has been part of breast cancer therapy now since 1979, colon cancer since, you know, the early 90s. Well, it's great that you're finally looking at it. Bevacizumab, a lot of stuff's going on with that.
Right.
I mean, and, you know, colon cancer, it's standard of care. You know, breast cancer, it's pretty much in metastatic. They're all in lung. Everybody uses the trials looking in the adjuvant setting.
Mm-hmm.
Renal cell, there was just some cool data presented on bevacizumab. So I don't know. I guess we're just kind of starting to look at prostate cancer, but hopefully we'll see those kinds of benefits.
Right. And it'll be interesting to see how well we're able to enroll in some of these trials. I mean, we're going to do our best. I mean, that's why, again, in our multidisciplinary clinic, we're trying to put all these trials right in there so that we can, you know, just incorporate that into the standard care of counseling.
You know, we were talking before about MAB and the fact that people are now more conscious of who are the men that you're really worried about. And so maybe that sensitivity will start to apply in terms of getting these people into trials so we have better answers for them. I mean, this guy, fine, you give him hormone therapy or not, or delayed, but I would guess his prognosis is not all that good. What do you think? If he were to say to you, you know, what's my chance that I'm going to die of prostate cancer, what would you say?
He's asked me that. He's actually asked me that.
Of course, we can't factor the chemo in at this point, but just in general, what would you say for a man with this situation, and or what did you say to him?
Well, I basically, you know, I honestly think that he's probably going to die of something else. And the reason I say that is that even though he had an element of Gleason 5 in there, we were able to get negative surgical margins. And even though it was high-grade disease, his tumor volume was relatively low. And maybe it's wishful thinking.
How old is he?
He's now 69.
And no other comorbid, and no heart disease or any serious...
Nothing major.
So there's a pretty good chance of, you know, going 10, 20 years without dying of something else.
Yeah.
What do you think the conventional nomograms and all would say about his chance of dying of prostate cancer?
Well, it's hard to know right now because, I mean, he has not experienced a PSA recurrence. I think I could...
Of course.
You know, he's still in the hormone therapy phase of the 2 years, and... For me, it's really hard to apply a nomogram. Now, if he experiences a rising PSA...
No, I'm talking about right now.
Yeah.
Rising PSA is another question.
Yeah.
Then you get into competing more... I'm just talking about the disease.
Yes. I really don't know what his...
I mean, do you think there's more than a 1 out of 3 chance he'll die of prostate cancer?
I think there's probably a less than 1 out of 3. The only reason I'm saying that...
Did he try to get that out of you the way I'm trying to pull it out of you?
Maybe not. Maybe not as aggressively as you are.
And
I should know this, but the reality is the only reason I'm hesitating is that I could just, you know, shoot from the hip and say, oh, Gleason 5+3, you
right.
know, he's going to be dead. And,
right.
But again, knowing what I know that he had the radical prostatectomy,
right.
it was high grade, low volume, negative margins, and he's gotten 2 years
of
4 month therapy and this
years,
chemotherapy.
Right.
For him as an individual, I'm a big believer in clinical trials and doing this therapy, and I really think in my heart that we really hit him hard and that we might actually win on this one.
Suppose I said he ought to be on androgen suppression for 5 or 10 years. And by that, I don't mean necessarily treatment, because I was really curious about Anthony D'Amico's recent work looking at duration of androgen suppression and that you might be off treatment. And I know that one of the key breakpoints was age 70, and he's like sort of on the border there, but that once you get over 70, a lot of times the testosterone doesn't come back. But, I mean, you know, this is, maybe you feel optimistic about this as a physician, but you look at the way you described the pathology in his surgery, and it certainly doesn't seem like a benign situation that's not a potential threat. And I just wonder about this whole issue of duration of androgen suppression. You know, in breast cancer, we're doing trials of 5 versus 10 years of endocrine therapy. I know it's not the same disease, but the perception has totally changed over the last few years. And again, here's this nuclear scientist right. who's all over this kind of thing. I mean, obviously he doesn't like the hot flashes, but are you going to look at his testosterone at this point, incidentally, once he stops the treatment?
If I'm not mistaken, I think they are measuring, getting periodic right. testosterone as part of the clinical trial.
Oh, I see.
But I don't recall, I don't know what the testosterone levels are. So he'll stop the hormone therapy at 2 years per protocol.
And I'm sure he's on the protocol too, so we'll have to follow that.
And then if you look at what I understand in the literature of stopping hormone therapy and rebound of testosterone, for average age individuals, it takes about 7 months supposedly for the testosterone to come back. On the other hand, this guy is approaching 70. So I probably wouldn't get a testosterone level until at least 6 months after he right. completes the hormone therapy. And you could argue maybe it's a waste of money to even do a testosterone level until he's out to 12 months.
And is it even going to change what you're going to do? I mean, it may be good to know about.
I don't think it's going to change anything in his case other than reassure him about the hot flashes going away.
Is there any value in looking at testosterone in men who have PSA progression to see whether or not this is occurring in the face of androgen suppression, even though they're off treatment?
I think that you mean in the setting of intermittent hormonal therapy.
No, I mean, for example, let's say you document that this man is having continued androgen suppression, even though he stopped his hormone therapy. So he's got low levels of testosterone, and then he develops PSA recurrence. Does that change your thinking about it, that it's sort of resistant to androgen suppression?
I think that's a great point. I don't think we know enough about that. But yes, I mean, if he has a PSA rise down the pike, I think we would need to know what his testosterone is. Again, at that point, he's going to be beyond age 70. He will have had 2 years of hormonal therapy under his belt. Whether his testosterone bounces back at this point, I think, is anybody's guess. And if it doesn't bounce back and he gets a PSA recurrence, I mean, by definition, he's going to be hormone refractory right from the get-go. And I don't know if we have enough data to know how that's going to behave. I mean, common sense would suggest that's not going to act as well as if his testosterone is normal.
It'd be cool to study that.
I think. Yeah. I don't think we have good data on that.